This is 15 Minute History, a podcast for educators, students, and history buffs featuring the minds and talents of the University of Texas at Austin. 15 Minute History is a partnership of Not Even Past and Hemispheres in the College of Liberal Arts at UT Austin.
Hi, I'm Joan Neuberger, editor of Not Even Past, and your host for today's episode of 15 Minute History. Today, we are in Trinity College, Cambridge University, once again recording on laptops, so our sound quality might not be quite what it is when we record at home in the studios. Today, we're here with Professor Dominic Levin, known to everyone as Chai. Hi, Chai. Welcome to 15 Minute History.
Here I am.
We're going to talk about Russia on the eve of World War I. So let's dive right in and begin with an overview of international conflicts that were smoldering in Europe at the beginning of the 20th century that ultimately led to World War I. Can you give us an overview?
Yes, I mean, the international conflicts were smoldering across the globe, though they were mostly driven by the European powers. So you have the Spanish-American War, then you have the Boer War, then you have the Russo-Japanese War, and then you zoom in to the immediate causes of the First World War, which are to do with the decline and seeming likely collapse of the Ottoman Empire. Firstly, the Italians pinch Libya from the Ottoman Turks, and that in turn leads into the Balkan Wars, when the various smaller Balkan states, the Serbs, the Bulgarians, and the Montenegrins and the Greeks, decide to carve up the remnants of the Ottoman Empire in Europe. And in a way, the First World War is actually the third of these Balkan Wars.
Good. And what were Russia's interests
Interests are worldwide. The problem is that Russian resources don't actually suffice to defend Russian interests worldwide. But specifically, after the defeat by Japan, they basically do a deal with the Japanese to close down danger on the Pacific front and concentrate their resources on trying to defend their interests in the Middle East and Europe. And that is above all to do with their sense that the Ottoman Empire is declining fast and likely to collapse. The Austrian Empire might follow it. And Russia has enormous interests in what we now describe as Turkey at the Straits, you know, of Constantinople and the Straits, and in southeastern Europe, which it needs to defend if necessary.
And so in the lead up to World War I, there were a number of international agreements in Europe to try and balance powers in Europe. Can you talk about what those were?
Well, the basic idea of balancing power in Europe is the idea, of course, of security, that if any one country is so powerful that it can push all the others around, what you need to do is gang up against it. And that, in a sense, is what had been going on in Europe for 100 years or more. The basic problem now, you know, after German unification in 1871 and the enormous growth of the German economy, is that Germany appears to be potentially the dominant power in Europe. So essentially, the Russians and the French gang up against it to make sure that neither of them will be pushed around. That, in turn, of course, scares the Germans. And it's out of this spiral of mutual fears and a basic idea that you're going to balance power and that is going to stop anyone from getting completely above themselves and trying to take over the top spot in Europe. Out of that comes the First World War.
Well, so let's focus on Russia a little bit. You've just written a book on the Russian Empire and the run-up to World War I. And like all other European states, Russia was a kind of nation state, and it was also the center of an enormous empire. How did the fact that Russia was an empire play into Russian foreign policy thinking in the early 20th century?
Well, I suppose the most basic distinction between Russia and certainly the West European empires is that whereas, you know, the English and the French and the Dutch and to some extent the Spanish had empires, Russia was one. And therefore, the boundaries between what you might describe as a Russian core state and the empire are very difficult to define. The basic point, though, for all these European states is that they reckon that unless they are countries of continental scale, with continental scale populations and resources, they're not going to be a great power in the 20th century, and that's for all sorts of obvious reasons. But the most basic is that they can look and see what's happening on the other side of the Atlantic, and they know that the United States is very soon going to be powerful on a scale which will dwarf any normal European country. Well, of course, Russia isn't a normal European country. It is attached to a great empire. And so the Russians are in this strange situation in which, at the moment, they feel themselves to be very weak and vulnerable. And they are indeed. You know, they're poorer, less powerful in most ways than the Germans. And yet they think that if they can hold together and develop their enormous economy for the next generation or so, they will be the only European country which can match the United States. So it's a complicated picture.
You've said that from the Russian point of view, there were three areas of geopolitics that mattered in shaping foreign policy: security, interests, and identity. Why don't we take those one at a time and start with what you mean by security?
Well, security essentially means balance of power. It essentially means that you need, you know, to be sufficiently powerful to ensure that your core interests are not trampled on. And the Franco-Russian alliance is the main Russian way they try and do this, because they fear being pushed around by Germany, and particularly by the German-Austrian alliance, which was signed in 1879. So balance of power is Russian security. The obvious point to make is that this isn't just Russia. I mean, the Russians put their faith in the balance of power in just the same way that the people in London and Paris did. And indeed, in principle, everybody believed in the balance of power. The problem was that the balance of power is always a dangerous idea, because in the first place, it's very difficult to decide, you know, who has got power. The only way you can really work it out is through war. Then you have to work out not just people's power, but also their intentions. And of course, that's even more complicated. And then specifically in the European case before 1914, if Germany was the obvious potential dominant power in Europe now, it was not entirely unrealistic to think that Russia might well be in a generation's time. So all the calculations are difficult.
And what do you mean by interests?
Well, Russia, like every country, certainly like every great power, has interests. Of course, those interests are to some extent common sense, you know, security, not allowing the invasion of your country, not being pushed around when it comes to international disputes over trade and other things. But specifically, Russia has a number of interests, not least because it covers the whole of northern Eurasia. You know, it's vulnerable in the Far East to the Japanese. It has real worries in the Caucasus, partly because external and internal problems can easily be linked, you know, revolution within and support from outside, the old imperial nightmare. But actually, between 1906 and 1914, the Russian government defines its key interests as being in, above all, the Middle East and southeastern Europe, which really means the Ottoman problem. Above all, the Russians are absolutely paranoid about the fate of what is usually called the Straits. In other words, the waterway which links the Black Sea to the Mediterranean. Most of Russian exports go out through that waterway. There is no alternative to them going out through that waterway. The percentage of Russian exports which are going to go out through that waterway is growing with every year. And therefore, the Russians are paranoid about protecting, you know, this key route. And because they think the Ottoman Empire is either going to collapse, so the Straits are going to be up for grabs, or in its weakness it is increasingly going to become a German protectorate, they get more and more fraught. And although that isn't the only element in Russian interests in Europe, it is the main one. That is what the biggest Russian concern is.
Mm-hmm. So we come back to the Ottoman Empire.
We come back to the Ottoman Empire. Again, one needs to put things in the context. Just as, you know, the other European capitals also thought in terms of the balance of power, and the British, for instance, worry about whether one's talking about the balance of power in Europe, where Germany seems to them the greater threat, or the balance of power in Asia, where Russia appears the greatest threat to their Indian Empire. Well, in just the same way at the Straits. I mean, of course, Russian ambitions at the Straits are a source of insecurity and fear in Europe. But you have to put that in the context of a world where the British have pinched the Suez Canal and taken over all Egypt to protect it. The Americans have pinched the Panama Canal and taken over a slice of Central America. This is the name of the game in those days. And actually, the Russians had greater interests at the Straits than the British did in Suez or the Americans in Panama, for the simple reason that the Russians had no other way to get their exports out.
And so what do you mean by identity?
Well, identity is always a bit more complicated, but fundamentally, it seems to me, identity means two things as regards Russia and foreign policy. Firstly is the idea that Russia is a Slav country, that it has a sort of historical mission, as was said at the time, to be the leader and protector of the world's Slav communities. And secondly, and more generally, that Russia is a great power, an empire. and that, you know, for any Russian, keeping Russia as a great power, making sure that Russia has a major say in the great questions, making sure that Russia is second to none, not humiliated, recognized by all as one of the key players in the world. This is very much part of what the Russian elites think of as, you know, their Russia. So it's those two things fundamentally. Again, you have to put it in the context. I mean, Russia's not unique. I mean, the British, the French, the Germans, and indeed the Americans in a slightly different way, all thought that, you know, being a German or being an American demanded ensuring that your country was one of the great countries in the world, which no one could ignore in the great questions which would determine the world's future. The Slav issue, of course, is a narrower one. And there are very specific aspects to the whole Russian Slavophile tradition. And yet again, it's a general question. After all, you know, in many ways, 20th century world history, at least until relatively recently, was a battle between what you could describe as a Russian-led bloc, a Germanic bloc, and an Anglo-Saxon, in other words, Anglo-American bloc, to dominate the world. And these were, of course, blocks defined by geopolitical interest, but also ethno-ideological identity. You know, the British and Americans won, and that's why we live in the world we do. It's not the only reason, but it's a very major one. So again, this Russian attempt to create what you could describe as a geopolitical ethno-ideological bloc is nothing strange. The main problem is that, firstly, the Russian Slavic bloc is not united. They all hate each other, Poles and Russians, Bulgarians and Serbs. Secondly, whereas in the German and Anglo-Saxon, Anglo-American case, you have blocs which are sustained by the sense that they're the leaders of civilization, you know, both culture and economics. Nobody thinks that Russia is the head of anything. I mean, it's a backward country, and certainly no one thinks that Tsarism is a desirable regime, a desirable ideology, which, of course, is not at all true when you're thinking of Anglo-American democracy, which has many admirers outside the UK and the USA. And then the third and most basic point is that even if all the Slavs had been united, and even if all Slavs looked up to Tsarism, Russia is a relatively backward country, and at least today, God knows the day after tomorrow, but today, the Russian bloc is much weaker than the big Germanic bloc of all the German peoples of Europe. And of course, it's incomparably weaker than the alliance putative of the British Empire and the United States, the world's English-speaking peoples. So the Russians are in a bind. And the fact that, you know, the Russians are weaker and are conscious of the fact that they're weaker helps to explain some of the paranoia.
A lot of what you're talking about comes together in two regions, in Ukraine in the early 20th century and in Russia's attitude towards Siberia. Could you talk about how those two regions played into the way Russia acted in the on the eve of World War I?
I mean, both the Ukrainian issue and the Siberian issue are, in a sense, empire. You know, this idea that to be a great power, to survive in the sort of dog-eat-dog great power politics of the 20th century, you need to be an empire. Well, the great threat to empire is nationalism. Now, it's still the case in 1914 that most of the Russian elite thinks of the Poles, or sometimes the Jews, or even occasionally Finns and this and that, as the biggest immediate threat to the empire. But the more foresighted Russian thinkers and statesmen see the Ukrainian threat as, in the long run, or the medium run, the most dangerous. And that is simply because without Ukraine, Russia ceases to be a great power. 70% of Russian coal and the metallurgical industry's produce comes from Ukraine. Ukraine produces most of the export grain, which is at the center of the Russian export economy, which itself is what allows Russia to import foreign capital, foreign technology, and is therefore the basis for the entire program of Russian economic development. So that's the first issue. The Ukrainian problem is also most serious, though, in the sense that if Ukrainians are Russians, then 67% of the Russian Empire's population are Russians. If Ukrainians and Belarusians are not, then only 44% are. And of course, that makes a huge difference in an era where it is usually taken that national identity, nationalism, is the best way to consolidate a political community and legitimize the state in the eyes of its subjects. So there is a very big security issue there. And the whole question of whether Ukrainians are a separate nation or whether they are a region of the Russian people is hugely significant.
And was it controversial at the time?
It was hugely controversial, and it was becoming more controversial with every day that went by. One has to remember that this isn't a battle between Russians and Ukrainians, or isn't just a battle. It's a big battle within the Ukrainian elites as well. Virtually the whole Ukrainian elite up to the 1850s is convinced that, though certainly they have a separate regional identity, they are not just Russian, but in many ways the most Russian of Russians. Because after all, what we now call Ukraine is where the Russian reigning dynasty came from. It's where the Orthodox Church came from. And in the old world, it's dynasty and church, religion, which determine identity. On top of that, there is a more acute sense of Russian identity often in Ukrainian Russian elites than there is in the heart of the Russian Empire, for the very simple reason this is a borderland. And the Ukrainian elites are traditionally fighting Poles, you know, to defend what they see as the Russian identity, the Russian, dynastic, all the other Russian identities against Polish cultural and political domination. Then you get the rise of capitalism, and they're obsessed with the power of Jewish elites, you know, as leaders of capitalism in the Western borderlands. So you have a situation which is not unique. It's often true that actually what we now call Ukraine, the borderland elites, in Ukraine, until certainly beyond the 1850s, are virtually unanimous in seeing themselves as the most Russian of Russian provinces. Then in the last 70 years of Imperial Russia, you get developments which include the emergence of a Ukrainian nationalist elite, which says, no, Ukrainians are not Russians. We are a separate nation, just like Poles are separate to Russians or Slovenes are separate to Croats. You know, the same kind of arguments you're getting in the rest of Europe. And therefore, potentially, we must have our own, not just national identity, but even sovereign independent state. Well, of course, for the Russian elites, this is absolute anathema. And so you get an increasingly bitter struggle, which is still, to a considerable extent, kept underground within the Russian Empire. Although after open politics becomes half possible with the Duma, the parliament in 1905, it does begin to come above ground. But of course, because 75% of Ukrainians live in the Russian Empire, but 25% in the Austrian Empire, Austrian Galicia, what we now call Western Ukraine, becomes the absolute heartland of Ukrainian nationalism. And that has a big effect in souring Russian-Austrian relations. That isn't yet the main issue in Russian-Austrian relations in 1914, but it's becoming bigger and bigger with every year that goes by, and it could very soon become as important an issue in Russo-Austrian relations as the Balkans.
And some of the most thoughtful foreign policy experts saw Ukraine as being an important borderland issue for the empire.
Some of the most important foreign policy experts, but also, as you might say, public intellectuals in Russia. So did some of the more intelligent security officials, you know. So this problem is there, and it's clearly likely to get worse.
And how does Siberia play into this?
The thing about Siberia is, for a Russian optimist, the world of the future. This is Russia's way out of the great dilemma, the great crisis it faces at the beginning of the 20th century. It's as if Britain, or even England, was attached to Canada, New Zealand, Australia, and a large portion of the United States. At that point, you know, it would be much easier to integrate all these areas into a greater Britain, which would be confident in remaining a superpower into the 20th, even 21st century. Well, Siberia plays that role for the Russians, and you have to understand that, you know, new technology is making this dream of Siberia's importance much more real, meaning the railway. With the railway, you can penetrate the heartland of Siberia, you can exploit its resources, you can enormously speed colonization. And therefore, you know, these Russians have dreams, seemingly very realistic dreams at the time, that the whole center of gravity of Russia will increasingly swing east. Within 100 years, you'll have, 450, perhaps 500 million Russians, you know, which will, of course, make the United States, though possibly China, its only competitors in the world. And not just that, Siberia is seen as a way of both ameliorating the social crisis, the social political crisis, by allowing peasants to flow into these newly accessible areas and therefore reduce the pressure on the land in Ukraine and Russia, which is one of the key causes of the agrarian revolution. But it will also allow large numbers of Ukrainians and Belarusians to flow into Siberia, where they will become a sort of new Russian amalgam. You know, in just the same way that Scots and Welsh and even Irish, and English, of course, who emigrated to Canada or Australia became sort of new British. They lost some of their local regional identities. Now, of course, in time, they acquired Australian, Canadian, New Zealand identities. But there was no chance of Siberia seceding from the Russian Empire. So there was some hope that, you know, you would create a new Russian identity out of Russians, Ukrainians, Belarusians in Siberia, in, after all, to some extent, the same way that people who emigrated to the United States didn't necessarily and immediately lose their ethnic identity, but they did acquire a broader American identity. So it's this kind of thinking, which through all the crises and the difficulties of the earliest 20th century does cheer up Nicholas II and, you know, some of his advisors.
So it gave Russians a sense that whatever happened in Eastern Europe and in the Balkans, there was always their backyard that would be there for future development. Is that
right? Basic feeling was yes, this is our future. But of course they were terrified that, you know, this future might be preempted by a war before they were ready to cope with it. And they had different answers to how they should respond to this danger.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that, given just from Russia's point of view, that the war could have been avoided? Were there voices within the foreign policy and military and diplomatic circles who were doing everything they could to avoid war? And at what point did they kind of let that go?
I think, you know, the great majority of members of the Russian ruling elite across the board before 14 want to avoid war. You have irresponsible politicians in the Duma. But in terms of the ministers, in terms of the immediate entourage, or indeed of Nicholas II, they all want to avoid war. Now, in certain cases, some of them want to avoid war for good if they possibly can, because you have a strain of humanitarianism, and they've all seen what happened in the Japanese War. But much more important is the sense that, firstly, we don't need a war. The future's on our side. We've got our empire. And secondly, a war now would be a catastrophe. We saw what happened in the Japanese War. Defeat could easily come against Germany, and defeat could bring revolution. In fact, defeat in the eyes of, I think, a large slice of the elite was seen as being almost certain to bring revolution. So, you know, whether they want to just postpone war or whether they hope to avoid it altogether, they do all want to avoid war. But of course, you know, you're in a pretty ruthless world. And it is a world in which, unless you stand up for your own interests, you might well get pushed to the wall. And, of course, this comes up over the Straits issue with German increasing influence at the Straits. It's also the case that, you know, there is a contradiction here because, of course, this is a regime whose legitimacy rests deeply in its military prestige, in its defence of Russian pride. And as it becomes less legitimate, as the domestic crisis grows, the need for the legitimacy that success in foreign policy, success in standing up for Russian pride brings, gets greater and greater. So you have this contradiction. And you have very powerful internal stresses towards, for instance, defending Russia's position as the leading Slav power, defending the interests of the Baltic Slav peoples. You know, all these things are not easy to dismiss or sideline, because even those who are somewhat sceptical about the Slavs and Russia's position there, nevertheless, in the first place themselves, usually have some sense of their debt to Russian history. You know, allowing the Germans and Austrians simply to dominate the Balkans, you know, makes them feel that they're somehow losing out or betraying their ancestors. But then there's the broader issue of the regime's legitimacy. And after all, as the regime attempts to build bridges to educated society, create a parliament, allow greater freedom of the press, you're actually liberating chauvinist voices. It's not at all the case that civil society, at least in some of its most more conservative aspects, or at least more centrist conservative aspects, is pacific. It isn't. The government is much more peaceful than civil society in that sense.
So all these issues, starting from where we started, the Straits, Ukraine, Siberia, economics, were controversial within the government. Gradually, a consensus grew that Russia would have to go to war. Is that what happened?
There was a growing consensus. I mean, what really provides the basis for the consensus is the alliance between, and this is particularly, of course, the foreign ministry, the professional people, that the balance of power is essential to Russian security. That means the French alliance, etc. And the idea in civil society that Russia must defend its historical interests in the Balkans, its dignity in the Balkans, and that this is all part of Russian identity. And those two elements come together. There are people who deny this. There are actually often very intelligent critics who deny this. But they are the outriders, and they're becoming more the outriders by 1914.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much, Chai.
Great.
For a transcript of this episode, alignments to the Texas and National Standards for Social Studies, and links to more information on this topic, visit our website at 15minutehistory.org. That's 15minutehistory.org. And for even more, you can like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. The University of Texas is a free speech campus. Opinions and viewpoints expressed in this or any episode of 15 Minute History do not reflect the official position of the University of Texas or of any of its constituent colleges or departments. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.